This is Rebecca Daniel Burke, your host for the American Counseling Association's 2009 podcast series. Today we are speaking with Dr. John Carlson regarding Alfred Adler. Dr. Carlson is a distinguished professor of psychology and counseling at Governor State University, University Park, Illinois, and a psychologist with the Lake Geneva Wellness Clinic in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. John is the author of 40 books, 150 journal articles, and the developer of over 200 DVDs and videotapes in the fields of counseling and psychotherapy, family therapy, brief therapy, substance abuse and treatment, parenting, and couples education. Dr. Carlson has received Distinguished Services Awards from the American Psychological Association, the American Counseling Association, the International Association of Marriage and Family Counselors, and the North American Society of Adlerian Psychology. He was named one of the five living legends in counseling in 2004 by the American Counseling Association. Welcome, Dr. John Carlson, and thank you for joining us today to discuss Alfred Adler.
Hey, it's my pleasure, Rebecca.
Wonderful. Okay. The first question that comes to mind is, why might I, as a counselor, be interested in studying the work of man who created his model about a century ago?
Yeah, that doesn't seem to make much sense on the surface, does it?
Yeah, it doesn't.
And I kind of wondered that same thing when I first started to study Adler's work. And the more that I've learned about Adler, I think he was at least 100 years ahead of his time.
Oh, yes.
And he developed an approach that talked about training rather than treatment, that treating people as though they needed skills, that they needed to learn. He viewed people in their social context, and he really believed that mentally healthy people were those people who got along with all the other people in their life. And this was such a break from what was going on with Freud, who was focusing more internally on the intrapersonal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Adler, his first paper that he wrote was on the tailoring industry and how the environment impacts the workers there. You know, really seeing that people get sick by the world around them, as opposed to the person being responsible, you know, for the sickness all within them.
Mm-hmm.
So his approach really fits the contemporary approaches that we use today in counseling and psychotherapy.
Mm-hmm.
He's kind of the founder, I guess, maybe the grandfather.
If
Freud was the father, he was the grandfather.
And Jung was what? He was the uncle.
He was out there, yes, somewhere.
Okay, does Adler's model take into account culture?
You know, it sure does. And I think that, you know, just as I mentioned before, you know, Adler was talking about what it's like to work in hostile conditions. He talked about, the impact of poverty. He grew up in an area in which war was going on. Prior to World War I, he was a minority. He was a Jewish person and of Jewish Hungarian descent, and was not very highly thought of. His wife was best friends with the Trotskys and talking about the social revolution, how we need to change the environment and the climate and all of these factors that marginalize people.
Mm-hmm.
So it very much addresses culture, and it may be the first one that did, first approach that really did focus on that.
Mm-hmm. Let's say I'm a counselor in a clinic, and I'm an Adlerian.
Mm-hmm.
A client walks in. How do I begin my work with the client?
I think if we look at Adler's work, Adler was the man who took the chair out from behind the couch.
Mm-hmm.
And he brought the chairs and faced one another.
Mm.
And I think that's probably a good metaphor to keep in mind, that Adler believed in treating people as equals.
Mm-hmm.
He really saw the person behind the symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
He was really trying to, validate and encourage people in realizing that we live our lives in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't try to pathologize people.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're a counselor and someone comes in, you're going to sit down and you're going to look at them and you're going to honor them.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to try to understand what they're about, not just their liabilities, but, mm-hmm. but more on their strengths, more mm-hmm. on their assets, because that's what you're going to use to help someone grow.
Mm-hmm.
I think mm-hmm. too much of counseling focuses on pathologizing people and
right.
seeing what's wrong with them, leaving people feel discouraged by our work.
Right.
And an Adlerian would be very encouraging.
And strength-based. I mean, that's something mm-hmm. we hear all the time now in our field.
Yes, yeah, yeah. And very, very much so.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Adlerian would see someone come in mm-hmm. needing courage, needing hope, mm-hmm. You know, needing to see that their life can be different.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so Adlerians work very hard at helping our clients to feel better when they leave, to feel more empowered, mm-hmm. to realize their strengths and assets.
That's wonderful. Now, is there an assessment tool that you like, or is it a matter of just, you know, working on the relationship, developing trust, that kind of thing, or is there some kind of assessment tool that you like to use?
Yeah, you know, the Adlerians go through four stages, and the second stage is that of assessment. The other three are the first stage is the relationship or the engagement phase,
mm-hmm.
where you really... you know, they do all of the things that Carl Rogers talked about, who, according to Richard Watts, actually took those things from a lecture that Adler gave, by the way, those core conditions.
Oh, isn't that interesting? I didn't know that.
Well, you know, you don't hear it from too many people. But
yeah.
So what you want to do is you want to engage and have a relationship. Then you assess, create insight, and reorientation. And so a way an Adlerian would assess someone is to look at a variety of things. The first thing you might look at someone's position within a family.
So the birth order.
The birth order mm-hmm. would be important. And we know things about firstborns and secondborns and mm-hmm. so forth, which help us to get an idea of how one sees the world.
Mm-hmm.
If you're an oldest, you may be more responsible. You may try to do things, you know, right. If you're a middle, you may believe that life is unfair. If you're second, you may strive harder.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a baby, you may feel more entitled as you go through life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The formal assessment that's used, though, is what's called the lifestyle assessment.
Mm-hmm.
And as part of that, you look at the person's place within their family, and mm-hmm. you have the person rank where they would fit in with their brothers and sisters,
mm-hmm.
like who would be the smartest, who would be the most athletic, who would be punished mm-hmm. the most.
Mm-hmm.
And so on through a variety of 24 different characteristics.
Mm-hmm.
By looking at where someone fits in as being the most or the least, you can get an idea about where they're finding their place within that particular family.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So the lifestyle assessment is a tool that's used.
That would be one. And in conjunction with that, too, you're also going to want to find out about one's relationships with mothers and fathers and mm-hmm. brothers and sisters, because mm-hmm. we know that mentally healthy people do have positive relationships with the significant people in their life.
Mm-hmm.
And when these are not going well, we assume that someone isn't feeling very well.
Mm-hmm.
We also do a strategy that's called early recollections. And early recollections is where we have someone talk about the earliest memories that they have. And these need to be memories under the age of 8.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're really looking for in that is someone, you know, in all of us, there's a few things we remember
mm-hmm.
out of the millions of things that have happened to us. And we're not so much interested in the factual content, but we're more interested in the psychological movement that's present in this early recollection.
Mm-hmm.
We're looking because we find that people remember things that fit who they are today.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, an example that I frequently use is someone gave an early recollection of wanting to get a cookie, seeing it on top of the cookie jar mm-hmm. that's sitting on top of the refrigerator, and really wanting that cookie and not knowing how to get it, and mm-hmm. then going and finding their uncle who goes and gets them a cookie.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
After successful counseling, the person asks for an early recollection, says, I wanted a cookie. I mm-hmm. saw it on top of the refrigerator.
Mm-hmm.
I pulled a chair up, and I climbed up on the chair and on the counter and got a cookie.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what's the difference between those two memories? Is mm-hmm. one is to get through life, to get the goodies in life, I need help. And in the later one, after counseling has occurred, the person begins to realize that I can get goodies in life on my own. And this is a very helpful tool. It's not the kind of thing that you do at a party, because it's very revealing.
Right.
It gets to someone's core beliefs about life and their role in it. I am, the world is, therefore.
Not this previous year, but the year before, I went to the NCDA conference, National Career Development, and one of the professors there was doing a roundtable and talking about using the first three memories, and he called this an Adlerian approach to career choice, using the first three memories, and they would somehow imply what one was to become in terms of their career. Are you familiar with that?
Yeah, I think you're talking about Dr. Savickas's model.
Yes.
It's very much rooted in Adlerian work. And he believes that he can take that, which is one's basic approach to life, and help someone find a career that fits that approach and their beliefs about things.
It was interesting.
Very talented, yes.
Yeah. And, of course, you would do – so all of this assessment that we're talking about, using the lifestyle assessment and looking at early recollections and relationships with your birth family, all of that would be done in the second phase. Is that correct? Stage.
Yeah. if life was really quite that simple, I think we're doing assessment all the time.
Yes.
We're doing this formal assessment in the second phase, but – there's more informal assessment. Informal assessment has to be with what happens to someone when they, between week to week, are they successful in implementing things? What are their stories as to why they do or don't, why they're not successful? And we see how their behavior just fits into this whole, model.
Adlerian therapy has been called individual psychology. So how would it work, or would it be appropriate for couples and families?
That was probably one of the biggest mistakes, if I can be so bold, that Adler made, was to call this approach individual psychology. Because that isn't what it meant.
Not what you're describing to us.
No,
yeah.
That was something that was lost in the translation. Individual really came from a German word that meant indivisible, which meant that people cannot be divided into parts, the ego, the id, the superego, and that we're holistic. And so this would be, better translated as holistic, better translated as we work with all facets, not just the individual. And so... that's lost in translation, I think.
Lost in translation and indivisible.
And so this approach works exceptionally well. Some people believe that Adler was the founder of family work back in the early part of his life in the 1920s. Adler set up child guidance clinics in the city of Vienna. And what he did in these child guidance clinics is he would counsel families live in front of an audience that fill up an auditorium, and he would work live with a family.
Isn't that amazing?
So much for confidentiality, right?
Right.
Adler had a famous quotation that said, "Everybody's normal until you get to know them." And, he really believed that we have that all of us need to develop the courage to be imperfect, because we all are imperfect.
Yes.
And when he would work with a family on a stage, he didn't see the family as the clients. He saw the clients as the audience.
And he
believed that since problems are universal, that if I can help the demonstration couple on the stage to deal with their issues via spectator therapy, I help the audience to acquire the same skills they need. He talked about a big shift that was going on in the world from autocratic living to democratic living, that there was a big change. We had revolutions going on, from the peasant revolution on to the women's, the different cultural groups, everyone wanting to be treated as equals, but nobody knew how to live as equals. And so what Adler was really attempting to do through this kind of work was psychoeducation, and he was teaching people the skills they needed to have to live democratically or equally. His approach also was works wonderfully in groups. There's several books written showing the Adlerian group model. There's the whole area of couples therapy is another. So individual is really the wrong name.
And yes, it seems like people are certain types, if you will, and one factor in that is birth order. And, you know, there's a lot of talk today about temperaments, that people have different temperaments and that there are types of temperaments. And I think we've tried for a long time to come up with types with Myers-Briggs and with the archetypes and all of that. Now, how are the birth order types different than those other types that we hear about?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that's really a good question that helps to talk more about the Adlerian model. Mm-hmm. And the Adlerian model is really a biopsychosocial model. Mm. And there's some biological temperament that we all have. People are just born differently. Mm-hmm. And that's something that's innate, and we're not sure why that is. But then there's the psychological, social part that we have some control over. And those are really something that's susceptible to change, too. Mm-hmm. And those are acquired in the social context that one grows up with, how they're treated, where they are in a birth order. Life is going to look very differently. Mm-hmm. You know, we see people, some people feel that the only way they can make it in life is to get what they want. Other people have to be bossy. Some people try to avoid things. We see some people control and some drive. Some people go through life feeling victimized. Everything happens to them. And those are learned. Those are learned behaviors. If you find someone who's a victim, you'll find they had a mother or father who taught them how to be that way. Often these are transgenerational patterns that go from one generation to the next to the next.
So if you worked with couples, for example, you might try to talk about their differences in terms of, you know, all sorts of things, but also birth order or temperament.
We'd certainly talk about that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, an Adlerian would also look at why people are attracted to one another.
Mm-hmm.
That's the biological. Mm-hmm. And the biological attractions are going to come from we're brought together with people who are different than us. That way that our offspring will have the greatest immunity in life. And the problem with this being brought together because of our differences is that most people have never learned how to deal with differences. And we even have myths in our culture that says if you're married, you should be alike, be the same. And yet you're drawn to this is God's joke that we're brought together kind of, you know, by differences. So an Adlerian is going to use education for one thing, and it's going to help couples to understand these differences and why they're there and how they're important, and to accept differences and to realize differences are a good thing. I think Khalil Gibran, the prophet, said we're supposed to be different. He said we're like pillars holding up a building. If we were the same and together, the building would fall over. There's got to be space between us.
Yes.
That space is that difference.
Yes.
The late Don Dinkmeyer and I wrote a program called Training in Marriage Enrichment, which is a 10-week-long program which teaches couples the skills they need to have to be successful. And these skills involve, you know, first of all, being present with one another.
Mm-hmm.
Understanding our differences, learning how to be positive and encouraging, learning how to solve differences and to solve conflicts that are inevitable, learning how to receive and give communication and receive and give love. And maybe most important of all, we need to realize that a marriage is not just the man or the woman or the two partners, but it's also the relationship. That's the third entity. And learning how to make choices that are good for the relationship is a skill that needs to be learned if you're going to be effectively married.
And is another piece of that the culture within which the couple's living?
There certainly is a cultural component, mm-hmm. you know, that we need mm-hmm. to take into account in terms of what marriage means in that culture, what the relationship means. You know, I mean,
yeah.
some cultures begin with, you know, first you get married, then you fall in love. In this culture, you're supposed to fall in love and then get married.
Right, right.
Yeah, and it really changes depending upon the culture. So we,
yes.
a few years ago, wrote a book on intimacy, and I've just finished another one, and just talking about what that means.
Mm-hmm.
In some cultures, like in Korea, they have no word for intimacy.
Oh, interesting.
And I finally pushed, what do you mean? What's the most intimate thing you can do, the most loving thing you can do?
Uh-huh.
And the person paused, and this is the late Insoo Kim Berg, and she said, I can cut the head off a fish and I can give it to my partner.
Uh-huh.
That was the most loving thing that she could do.
Yeah. It's, you know, I worked in Korea, it was very interesting. We had to learn as counselors about the culture. And one of the things in Korea and Japan, both of which I worked in, they don't want you to look them in the eye. They don't want the eye contact. Mm-hmm. It's uncomfortable. And
right.
it's in some way not being polite.
It's offensive.
Right. We had, you know, we really had to learn that if we were going to be working there. And so that's interesting. So you talk about that in your new book.
Mm-hmm. Right.
What's the title of your new book, by the way?
The new one's called Restoring Intimacy.
Oh, okay.
And it's done with a colleague of mine, Len Sperry, and it really has to do with looking at what happens when relationships are broken, whether it's through mm-hmm. infidelity or maybe mm-hmm. it's the internet, maybe it's work, maybe it's financial disagreements,
mm-hmm.
a whole variety of differences. And then mm-hmm. how we restore that and how that restoration will take place in different cultures.
Hmm. That's wonderful. It's interesting that you mentioned the internet, too, because we certainly hear a lot about that as counselors in terms of problems with couples.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's another way to have a violation. I think the whole electronic age is something that's kind of snuck up on all of us. There's that
mm-hmm.
old story that if you put a frog in a pot of boiling water, it'll jump out. But mm-hmm. if you put a frog in a pot and gradually heat it, you'll cook them. And many of us are getting cooked by
mm-hmm.
our relationships that we have with electronic commitment. You know, as I'm
mm-hmm.
sitting here, I've got a computer on, I've got my cell phone on, I've
mm-hmm.
got this phone, I've got another television,
mm-hmm.
I've got all of these things. Well, how do I make a decision to
mm-hmm.
have a relationship with a real person?
Mm-hmm.
And we're finding that more and more people are choosing to relate to machines. Like
you
Bill
know,
Moyer said that. He said, our children are being raised by appliances.
It's that's interesting, but I will tell you that certainly in terms of intimacy, I see a real generational shift. And here's a personal example. I have a daughter who's 24, and she was going to go out with this gentleman, and I noticed that they were sending text messages back and forth all day. And I said, don't you just feel like picking up the phone and talking to this young man? She said, no, Mom, we'll talk tonight. Like, why are you even saying? And I thought, well, in my generation, you know, we really would have preferred to pick up the phone and have a conversation.
Yeah. You know, and then another question comes is, what do they do when they go out on dates?
Yeah.
Do they talk to each other, or are they talking to each other using their cell phones?
Mm-hmm.
Or are
mm-hmm.
they texting when they could be talking?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the brave new world.
But this is just a different type of a relationship. And
mm-hmm.
and we say, unfortunately, we say, are you connected? And
mm-hmm.
it's more or less saying, are you disconnected?
Mm. Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. Well, back to Adler for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
How does the Adlerian help bring about change?
Well, that's not a simple question, but
not simple. Mm-hmm.
You know, what we say is that it moves into insight.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm. The insight stage.
I mean, through therapy, clients can learn about their mistaken goals. And, you know, once they're aware of these goals, they can decide whether to change things or to not change things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, an Adlerian therapist would certainly respect that. But once they know their mistaken goals, we hope that our clients can then recognize patterns in their motivation. And then, you know, with this insight and belief of the therapist to change or the counselor to change, they can really address this. I think clients can learn that new behaviors might work better than their older ones. I mean, I frequently find myself saying to clients, well, how is it working? And they'll say, not very well, as they start to laugh.
Yeah.
And then they move into change. But, you know, Adlerians, like other professionals today, realize that just because somebody comes to see you doesn't mean they're ready for change.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
we see readiness for change following a continuum, you know, using the model that Jim Prochaska and mm-hmm. others talked about, this trans-theoretical model for mm-hmm. helping that people move from, from just starting to be aware that they need change, to contemplating change, to mm-hmm. planning change, to taking action, to following through.
Mm-hmm.
And, and Adlerians really try to tailor their approach to help couples or to help couples and individuals to use their insight to create a different life. So I'm not sure if that's too much.
Great. One thing I think, you know, often in the field of counseling we'll hear about, like any theory that's insight-oriented, and we'll be concerned that it won't fit in any of the brief therapy models that so many of us are in. Honestly, I think there's a place for both of them. But is there a way in which this insight-oriented work can fit into a briefer model?
I certainly believe so. Mm-hmm. You know, in the examples of my work that are on tapes, mm-hmm. I think it's pretty clear to see how quickly one can move using this model. But mm-hmm. you have to be very active as a therapist.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's is a challenge for a lot of people, is being active and directive, and some might even call it being confrontative.
Mm-hmm. Can you give us an example of that? What might be happening in a session where you might have to become more directive, more active,
mm-hmm.
confrontational?
Well, you know, I think it happens in just about all sessions, mm-hmm. you know, that mm-hmm. you work with someone. I'll try to picture somebody that, you know, maybe I've, you know, I've seen this week. I mean, just mm-hmm. quickly just check a schedule here. You know, I still see quite a few people each week, and let's see, you know, there's a young man that I saw this week who continues to drink, and yet he doesn't want to go to AA meetings, and he doesn't want to go to Vipassana meditation. Vipassana is a way that it's just mindfulness meditation would teach somebody. Is it really a big correlation that people can learn a tool like this? They can learn to urge surf, and they can learn to say no to negative choices that they've been making, these, mm-hmm. you know, destructive choices. And so, mm-hmm. You know, each week he comes in, I say, are you ready to do something? And he, you know, he'd say no, and I say, where are you this week?
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. And he gives me a number from 20% to 30%. Right now he's at 60%, but during the time he's had a second DUI, he's been in jail for 30 days.
Oh, my goodness. Uh-huh.
But I will keep saying, so how is this working for you so far?
Yeah.
And he keeps saying, well, it's not working very well.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, rather than, you know, moving and pushing somebody too much,
uh-huh.
we'd really say, so what's your next step?
Uh-huh.
What do you think, what will have to happen before you'll be ready?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And, you know, and
great
very
question.
Active and very active and directive.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Yet it's respectful.
So. Yes, and it doesn't sound pushy. What you're describing mm-hmm. doesn't sound pushy at all.
Right. So hopefully that's the case.
Yeah. I write a column for Counseling Today on career counselor stories, and I was interviewing someone yesterday for that. And I always ask them, you know, what mistakes have you made along your career path, and even more importantly, what lessons have you learned from those mistakes? And she said something that I have heard a number of times from people I have interviewed, and it's often trying to push change too quickly before the client was ready.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, and what you just said was a way of, you know, you were presenting what you see mm-hmm. occurring, but you weren't saying, now we need this to happen now kind of thing.
You know, even sometimes I would say this paradox that, you know, it's up to you if you want to change. If you change, I'm delighted because I feel like I'm a great therapist. And if you don't change, then I'm going to make a lot of money and I'll put an addition on the side of my house.
I love that. That's great.
No, this is all tongue in cheek, of course.
I know. But, yeah, but, you know, there's a place for the longer-term, insight-oriented type work and a place for brief therapy, too. You know, I think they can both coexist, you know.
And even what brief therapy is mm-hmm. brief therapy is not really brief therapy. I mean, all therapy, we hope, is brief. I mean, mm-hmm. Adler thought
sure.
therapy should be as quick as possible. I mean, no one wants to buy a lifelong friend.
Mm-hmm.
This way, they come to see us because they want something to be different. But all brief mm-hmm. therapy does is just to break down and take this piece, this piece, this piece, this piece,
mm-hmm.
and longer term therapy does the same thing. It just keeps going. Mm-hmm. You work on this piece, and then when you move on, you work on the next,
mm-hmm.
and the next, and the next, and it evolves.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you know, sometimes people want to work on it all in one big chunk, and sometimes
right.
people want to break it up.
Right. Right. I remember when my friend was going through a divorce, and he called me and said, do you have somebody you could recommend? And I went to my list of counselors, was trying to find somebody for him, and I said, tell me what you're looking for. And he said, I'm looking for the whole therapy experience to be over in 2 sessions.
Yeah, there you go.
I said, wow. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's anyone on my list that can work that way. But
mm-hmm. Well, you know, then what I would ask them is, what do you see as your role in this, and what do you see as my role?
Mm-hmm.
And in any kind of brief work you're going to do is you need to find out what people want, how mm-hmm. they expect to get it, and then you need to be that person. You need to be the authentic chameleon.
Mm-hmm.
And Adler would always try to tailor things for the clients that he worked with.
I like that authentic mm-hmm. chameleon.
Yeah, that's from Arnie Lazarus.
Multimodal
therapist.
Yeah. That's wonderful. Speaking of brief therapy, how does the Adlerian approach fit with other contemporary approaches to counseling?
You know, I think very well. I've been a presenter at the annual brief therapy conference every year for the last many years, and I get a chance to work with all the other folks, the solution-focused and the CBT and the Ericksonian
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
all of the different models. And there's a lot of respect. And most of these people realize that at the root of their ideas is Adler and that he was the person who talked about solutions, focusing on what works. He was the one who talked about changing thinking and how our thoughts limit, you know, what we can be.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he also acknowledged feelings and behaviors. So I think there's a great respect. And from the work of contemporary Adlerians, we see this mm-hmm. model as an integrative model.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, well, that we're able to pull together and we're able to utilize the good ideas of all of these other approaches to therapy, because, you know, Adler used the biopsychosocial model. He worked with the mind, he worked with the body, he worked mm-hmm. with spirituality, he worked with feelings. It was holistic. You can't divide people up into segments, and you try to help people where they are.
Mm-hmm.
So you really need to be flexible, and maybe flexible is what I mean by integrative as well.
Mm-hmm. Just, I'm going to backtrack for just a minute.
One size does not fit all.
One size does not fit all. I'm going to backtrack for just a moment because we're, because you're talking about Adler as being almost the father of these therapies that we were all trained in when we got our master's in counseling, our PhD, or both. We were trained in these models. Now, could you say something about Adler's parting from Freud? Because I think he was very briefly a Freud devotee, or maybe that's too strong a word.
Well, yeah, you know, for about 10 years, Adler and Freud were colleagues. Mm-hmm. Adler had already been trained. He never saw himself as a student of Freud.
Okay.
And in 1911, he broke with Freud. At that time, he was president of the Analytical Society. He tried really hard to go along with what Freud was doing, but Freud's ideas were just way too dark. They were too focused on instinct and determination and taking away choice.
And that was in 1911?
1911 is when he broke.
And is it 1914 when Jung broke from Freud?
Shortly after that. Right.
Okay, so it was Adler first. Okay.
Yes. You know, and I think the difference was, too, is that when he broke, Adler was the blue-collar guy in, you know, out of the three of them.
Sure.
He was the guy who didn't think you could sit there and talk to people one-on-one. Mm-hmm. He thought the world was going to heck in a handbasket. You know, and Freud's entire caseload for his entire life was 125 people. And Adler would see twice that in his auditoriums. And he thought people really needed help. And so he was really like a self-help person. He was, you know, he was very, very popular. Mm-hmm. His book that came out, Understanding Human Behavior, sold 100,000 copies in the first 6 months. And Freud's book on dreams had been out for 20 years and had only sold 15 or 20,000 all total.
Amazing.
And today it's really switched. I mean, you know, if you think of Adler, Adler was like Dr. Phil. He you know, he would pack auditoriums. He would send people away. He was a great orator, not a great writer, but he was addressing common folk. And the Freudians and the behaviorists had the lock on the training facilities. They wrote the training books. They trained people to help others following those models, where Adler was out lecturing to people. And so when professionals like us went to school, we didn't get courses in Adler. We didn't get him listed as a theorist.
Right.
Because he was locked out of the, you know, these schools, these training facilities. But in recent time, he's come back and kind of been hanging around the fringes all along, especially in the field of counseling. And counseling views Adler as one of its real founders and leaders because he was very pragmatic, and counselors are very pragmatic. So, I mean, I still haven't understood what Freud and Jung are talking about.
It's not that easy, is it?
No, but, you know, there's not many analysts anymore anyway.
Freud
is most popular in literature
these
days, so whatever that's worth.
Back to my other question about how does this approach fit with other contemporary approaches to counseling. Do you have more to say on that?
Sure. I mean, you know, I've been good friends with a lot of the leaders. I mean, Bill Glasser is a good friend. And, and he sees, you know, that, that Adler and reality therapy are very complementary to one another. We see Albert Ellis felt the same way. Abe Maslow on his deathbed thought that every day he lived more and more, Adler was right. We see constructivist theories really looking to Adler as the person who really taught about how we construct our own realities. We look at Aaron Beck and Judy Beck, and they all paid homage to Adler as the founder of that approach, of those approaches. So, I mean, there's some real connections with whether it be with Rogers or who studied Adler, or whether it's the existentialist like Rollo May, who was Adler was his therapist, his analyst.
I didn't know that. Interesting.
So there's a lot of similarity in these approaches, but not a lot of credit given. And I hate to seem like the person who says, you know, Nana, we're victims, but. I think somebody said it well. You know, history hasn't treated Adlerians very well.
Yeah, when you come to understand a bit more about Adler, I see him as a tremendous influence on Carl mm-hmm. Rogers. Tremendous
right.
influence. And every counselor knows about Carl Rogers. And the, you know, sitting with the client, being genuine, letting the first part be about relationship and about warmth and genuineness and all of that. I really see it as having a lot to do with Adler.
Yeah, you know, and just some of these quotations that you know, I'm going to give you a few. Cause,
okay, yes.
You know, things like, you know, man knows more than he understands.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's an Adlerian quote.
Mm-hmm.
Conduct springs from contact. There's no virtues on an empty island. You know, talks about the importance of this connection. Or it's mm-hmm. always easier to fight for one's principles than live up to them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when a patient comes to see him, Adler never asked how ill is she or he.
Right.
But always how much in him is still healthy.
Right.
And so
right.
I think as you look at some of these quotations, you can start mm-hmm. to see the connections
mm-hmm.
To the other major theories.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, you cannot always alter facts. You cannot alter facts, but you can alter the way we look at them,
mm-hmm.
which is all what REBT and CEBT is about.
And the strength-based approach, we hear a lot about strength-based. I remember that I was trying to teach some people in a clinic once about how to arrive at, you know, at this client's strengths and work with from a strength-based approach. And we were in a Hawaiian island at the time, and this young man kept saying, I'm not good at anything. And I said, no, I know that's not true. I know you're good at something. And he mm-hmm. said, I'm good at diving down and catching fish with my spear.
Mm.
And I said, okay, that's what we're going to start your assessment with, that he is good at diving down and catching fish with his spear. And there's something important about just learning how to identify strengths, no matter mm. where they are, what culture they're in. And this has really mm. come from Adler.
Well, yeah, and I say I would probably say, well, it sounds like you're the best at not being good at anything. Are you good enough at a lot of things?
Uh-huh.
And you know, and there's a lot of strength to somebody who's balanced and is a generalist uh-huh. and follows the middle path and is not an extremist.
Mm-hmm.
So Adlerians talked a lot about reframing and talked mm-hmm. a lot about paradox. I think it was, you know, probably the one thing about Adler that we haven't touched on, and
uh-huh.
which may be the one of the most important things is uh-huh. what Adler did was he kind of brought religion into therapy. I mean, he mm. talked about Gemeinschaftsgefühl, about having social interests that, and he took a goal of love thy neighbor, which is really the same of every religion, you know,
right.
that you're supposed to treat others, but. But Adler did what nobody else had ever done, no scientist. He tried to put science and religion in the same goal. He tried to train human beings
huh.
in such a way that this goal of love thy neighbor could be reached.
Mm-hmm.
And he was not a particularly, you know, religious man, but he was certainly a spiritual man. And he realized the importance of these, these principles that go on from century to century that we all talk about, but we don't
mm-hmm.
live.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're finding out the importance of that now, about how we treat others. We're finding out that generosity is so important in happiness. And we're finding out, so many of these religious concepts and constructs are the same as those we find in mental health.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I spent the last 10 years, I've worked in Thailand, and I go there every year for 2 or 3 weeks and
oh.
teach throughout the country. And,
uh-huh.
you know, I'm convinced that Adler was born in Bangkok because the ideas that he talked about are so compatible with Buddhism.
Give us an example of that.
Well, you know, the Buddhists talk about the highest thing you can do is make merit. And when you make merit, you do thoughtful things for other people. You're giving for other people. You're trying to make other people feel better.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the hallmark of this culture is social interest, thinking of others.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what Adler was trying to talk about, too, was, you know, if somebody was feeling, i.e. mentally ill, and, you know, they'd come in and would talk about how bad they feel about this and how bad they feel about that. Andrew wouldn't do that. He'd say, go help somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, get the focus off of the narcissistic, off of the self, off of the ego,
mm-hmm.
and get it on to connecting with others. And as people start to do that, they come back into the world, and mm-hmm. pretty soon they're starting to feel better.
Absolutely.
And he would actively help people to connect with others.
Mm-hmm.
And to be of service to others. I mean, there's a therapist I know, again, named Nick Ioannidis, who worked in Maryland, and he would have dances every Friday night for his clients and patients. And he was a Greek man, and they would have mm-hmm. Greek dancing, and he mm-hmm. would socialize. He would teach people, find it, give them a place to belong,
mm-hmm.
a place to fit in. And belonging is a basic need. And
mm-hmm.
so many people don't have meaningful places to belong today.
I think that's one of the draws of the 12-step program and mm-hmm. And Alcoholics Anonymous and all the other 12-step programs is that, you know, there's a belonging, there's a kinship.
and that's a part where Adlerians would support that, but the Adlerians wouldn't support 12-step work because 12-step work starts by giving up power.
Okay.
You know, and you need to give your power away, and Adlerians wouldn't. We want people to gain power and to be more courageous. And,
right.
But you're right, that belonging, that place to fit in, that place where you're not going to be judged, that place where everyone is accepted.
Community.
We're not accepted for our behaviors, but mm-hmm. we're accepted as people who are struggling through life.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have a last question for you. This has really been fascinating. In the last question, always the one I'm always interested in is, our listeners, the listeners who will be our members, ACA members, many of them are master's level working counselors. Mm-hmm. They're very interested in new techniques and that kind of thing. What do you have to say to this group? Is there anything we've missed, anything you want to say addressing this group in specific?
Yeah, you know, it's probably, I guess I've only been an ACA member since 1968, so I'm speaking for 41 years. And the part that probably troubles me the most about professionals today is how they're struggling so much to their curiosity is gone.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that people today are, you know, really trying to learn things as if this is an exact science. We're going out and we're trying to learn exactly how to handle ethical dilemmas. And
mm-hmm.
we're not learning these bigger principles such as do no harm.
Mm-hmm.
We're going out and we're taking classes because we want CEUs,
mm-hmm.
not that we want to pursue knowledge or inquiry. And this profession is so exciting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Once we give ourselves the freedom to you know, move beyond some of these constraints of CEUs, and we have to do this and we have to do that, and
right.
to really focus more on growing and learning and helping.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if that's much wisdom, but
no, it is because it's very easy to get focused on, you know, I have to get this many CEUs by this date, and you know, I have to keep my my license in good standing, and to stop thinking about what this is all about and how all of this mental health field came about.
I mean, we never had licenses. We didn't have CEUs.
Mm-hmm.
We just took money out of our pocket and we went and learned things that seemed interesting and helpful.
Right.
And I don't see anybody doing much of that today.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point.
I think the demand isn't there, the need is. And I hope that we can all, you know, somehow we can facilitate this curiosity.
Yes, that's a good word.
Otherwise, we're going to have a whole bunch of automatons out there doing this work.
And we don't want that. That's no good. I don't like it. Okay, well, thank you so much, Dr. John Carlson, for joining me today to discuss Alfred Adler.
My honor. Thank you.
All right. To view links to this program or to write to the presenter or the host, go to www.counseling.org and click on the podcast page. This is Rebecca Daniel Burke, your host for the ACA 2009 podcast series, signing off.